Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
For longtime music fans in Wilmington, North Carolina, there never has been and never will be another rock club like the Mad Monk. This year marks the 25th anniversary of when the Monk closed for good back in 1996. And yet, a quarter century after the last band played there, the club continues to live on in the local imagination. There are two Facebook groups with thousands of members each that relive not only the good times, but also the memories of seeing the many, many bands who took the Monk stage. It's a long list. Punk legends like the Ramones, pop acts like Hootie and the Blowfish and the Dave Matthews Band, hard rock and heavy metal from Pantera, Motorhead, and Helmet, hip-hop from Run DMC, Public Enemy, and Ice Cube. And that's not to mention the hundreds of local and regional acts like Sidewinder, Faith Collapsing, and After Forever, who played the Monk's two locations over the 13 years of its existence at a time when Wilmington was considerably smaller than it is today. Welcome to Cape Fear Unearthed, the podcast exploring the legends, historical oddities, and landmark stories of southeastern North Carolina. I'm your host, John Staton. This is my first episode of Cape Fear Unearthed, and I'm a reporter with the Star News here in Wilmington. We're a Gannett paper that's part of the USA Today network. This week on the show, we'll be talking about the Mad Monk, which first opened in March of 1983 on Market Street near the College Road overpass, kind of where Carrabba's restaurant is now. It was owned and operated by Charlie Maltzby, a gregarious, larger-than-life figure, who also owned the popular Red Dogs Bar in Wrightsville Beach. 30 years ago in 1991, a fire at the original Monk location forced Maltzby to move the club across College Road to what was then called Marketplace Mall. The space the Monk used to occupy is now the Tin Pin Alley Bowling Alley. In that location, the new Monk, as it was sometimes called, continued what Maltzby started at the original location, bringing in a steady stream of local and touring bands before closing in 1996. Here with me to talk about the Mad Monk, what made it special, its history, its legacy, is Jeff Reed. Jeff has a long history in Wilmington as a musician, a music writer, a producer. In fact, we're recording this podcast in Jeff's home studio here in Wilmington. Jeff was there for the Monk's early days in its original location, while I was more of a regular at the new Monk after graduating college and moving back to Wilmington, where I grew up in 1992. All right, so Jeff, what are your first memories of the Mad Monk? You moved back here in the early 80s, and the Monk opened in about 83.
Yeah, right. I think my first memories of the Mad Monk basically was the marquee going back and forth down Market Street, because it was extraordinary to see 5 to 6 dates of live music on it. And then you'd always wonder, communication being the way it was back then, and no cell phones and internet and all that, I mean, it was just a great way to tell you what was happening in the club. So I think my first impression of it was like, hey, I mean, there's some things happening. And it brought to memory a lot of course, there were regional bands that were on the marquee, but then there'd be some national acts, too, that would catch your attention that you may or may not get over the radio, and certainly not over the TV at the time.
Yeah.
So, but I think that was essentially, my first impression of it in terms of not even going, but just saying there's something happening over there.
Yeah, well, and then I know some of the early bands that played were like the Romantics. That was one of the bands that people talk about a lot, and but that sound was like very distinctive. I even have vague memories as a teenager of kind of driving past there, and it's kind of this dirty looking, kind of ramshackle looking building. I remember going there later, but what was it like in there? What was it? I mean, I know it wasn't like an architectural marvel or anything.
No, well, originally that whole parcel of property was a junkyard. I mean, literally a junkyard.
Oh wow!
And over several acres, I don't know what the actual acreage was. but it was a junkyard. So essentially that building that became the Mad Monk was the chop shop. That's where they took apart things in those cars and sold the engines and the radiators and things like that. So it was a block building, okay? And so that when they did take it over to make it a venue, it was basically a square block building that they were able to frame inside and build the large stage and the upstairs and things like that. So essentially that was what it was like inside in terms of where it had come. But, you know, the other thing was the huge, huge parking lot.
Yeah, I do remember that.
It was, you know, certainly not. There might have been a few little asphalt coverings of it at one time or another, but basically it was a huge dirt parking lot.
It was a mud pit.
It was, yeah, if it rained, it was a mud pit, absolutely. So I think that was really kind of an incredible little thing in terms of the parking lot was so huge, because in venues prior, say the Crest out Wrightsville Beach from 73 to 81, I mean, parking was always a problem, as it is even today with the residents of Wrightsville Beach and such like that. So
it was just
carefree, and you were able to park it no problem. But that was basically my first impression, and the fact that there was a lot of musical genres represented on that marquee, and what they were bringing into town was pretty fantastic.
Well, then, you know, and I've heard, you know, different people say that it was pretty much a hit from day one, because I think it was previously a club called the Four Winds.
Right.
And then it pretty quickly, Charlie Maltsby took it over and kind of changed its personality a little bit.
Yeah, I think even Four Winds had the outdoor bar section,
and
which I think was also something that was quite interesting, even though it was kind of semi-closed in with screens and kind of a patio thing, but it was huge. And he had a bar out there, and he had a stage out there, and, you know, that he would have reggae bands coming in. And you've got to remember, in the early 80s in the United States, reggae was pretty authentic at that time. These bands were from Trinidad and Tobago and those kind of things. So the constant and the continual entertainment was a lot of variety.
Well, that was one thing that I always heard, was that Charlie was one of the first people to really bring reggae bands here, because, you know, I mean, I don't really remember hearing about reggae till in the 80s,
well,
Bob Marley and all that. But
yeah,
I mean,
and certainly was not getting any rare airplay.
Yeah, for sure.
Not in Wilmington, that's for sure. And even across the nation, Bob Marley and them in the mid-70s started to hit it in the United States, but it was still an extremely small genre.
Yeah.
But with the beach communities and that kind of thing, and then they became groups around the college towns that started to develop, the Amateurs, Raleigh Gray,
guys,
and Sunfire. These were regional bands with some connection to the islands.
Yeah. No, Raleigh Gray, they were based in Chapel Hill. I actually interviewed them when I was in college and sat on Raleigh Gray's front porch. He was a great guy. And, well, then by the late 80s, that's kind of when I really kind of started taking notice, because I was in high school, you know, you would see, like, Run DMC is coming through there. I would come back home from college in the summers and go see a band like Sex Police from Raleigh, kind of a funk, kind of a Chili Peppers thing going on.
The Circle Jerks, the DBs.
Oh, wow, man. And then, well, then it kind of, I'd say like within 5 years, it's almost like it's got, you know, icon status, and not even, you know, just a five-year-old place, and it's already, you know, it's almost already a legend, right? I think Blue Velvet got shot there in 86, and that's... And you kind of have a theory I like to explore, that kind of how it was just like on the perfect storm of factors that kind of just led the Mad Monk becoming this kind of legendary institution.
I think it all starts with the ownership and the management first. Let's go ahead and throw that out there, because, you know, running a bar in any type of situation is very, very difficult.
So dicey.
And so the longevity has to go with Charlie and his partner and his staff over
Absolutely.
The time. But I think in Wilmington, there really was a perfect storm. I think if you look at the history and the cultural things that were happening at the time. In January 1979, liquor by the drink passed in New Hanover County after so many years of trying to get that passed.
Right.
And that was a huge had a huge effect on tourism, had a huge effect on the local climate as well. Well, just the fact that you could go somewhere and not have to bring and have a mixed drink, which growing up in Wilmington in New Hanover County and essentially a dry county, that kind of made you feel like an adult, to say the least. But it also offered more service for the industry, be it the bar service or the restaurant industry. I think at that point, you could become a private club, which the Mad Monk was, and it you would sign in and have a membership, and then you could serve alcohol mixed drinks. With a restaurant, I think the percentage was you had to serve 51% food and 49% alcohol.
Yeah.
And so they kept those percentages pretty well. So it was huge in terms of us being a part of the real world, if you can put it that way. I mean, growing up here, I mean, we always seemed to be a backwater. We were always kind of looking at California or the other areas and saying, you know, we want to be more like them, you know. And so I think that was essentially one of the first things that happened. And it changed the industry and in terms of the restaurant industry.
Yeah.
And ultimately it changed the entertainment and the folks that could get here because obviously high profits in that business and you were able to turn that back into creating entertainment. The other major thing, obviously, is it's been explored in many forums is the movie industry. I mean, there was another thing that kind of gave Wilmington street cred, if you will. I mean, you know, at that time in the early 80s, we were looking at essentially about 120,000 people living full-time in New Hanover County. Now, when you compare it today of 240,000, we were still a small, backwater little town. This is before I-40. And so when the movie industry came, and it being a small town, everybody was abuzz about who was seen where, what was being filmed. There was a real romance with the industry at that time, as there is kind of now, but the luster's kind of
It was totally different back then because just to sidetrack for a second, I was in high school in the late 80s and going down and being an extra and like, you know, dream a little dream and, you know, standing next to like Corey Feldman and Corey Haim.
Right.
It was fun. And then they actually filmed, you know, a very pivotal scene of Blue Velvet there at the old Mad Monk on the stage there. And that had to give it a little more cachet and just like, you know, cred, like you said.
Yeah, Wilmington was just a buzz with the movie industry. I mean, it really, really was. And it just made us feel more a part of and making us feel special.
Yeah.
You know, more so than maybe other cities in North Carolina at that time.
Well, and then I love the other idea of, you know, how the... That was the MTV generation, right? I mean, MTV came out in, you know, early 80s, by the mid-80s, it was huge. And that had to have just kind of pumped up the whole music industry, made people more interested in bands, wanting to go see live music.
Yeah. When MTV came on board, it was August 1981. And my gosh, you know, the radio stations, I really haven't done a count on them. There were a few FM stations, but mostly AM here at this time. So not only were you able to hear music that you normally would not hear over the airwaves, you were actually seeing the artist. And it changed everything. It changed everything nationally, internationally, everything, and changed the music industry. But as a result, it became more familiar to folks.
Yeah.
And it created... to where you could see a band and see what they look like rather than, you know, listening to them for years before you even could tell.
So. Yeah, well, like the Romantics, they were a huge MTV band. I mean, and they played there at least a couple of times.
Right.
Someone like, you know, Run DMC would not have been who they were without MTV.
Right.
Or certainly D-Light. I know they came, that was a little later, maybe at the New Monk. They were, you know, also huge on MTV. So.
Right.
And then so it just kind of ended. And I was not here when the Monk burned down in 91.
Right.
I think it was kind of maybe almost at the height of its popularity.
Right.
I mean, it was, and then all of a sudden it just kind of, I think people were just out of nowhere, you know, the Monk is gone, right?
Yeah. The Monk is gone and, you know, what are we going to do now? That kind of thing. And it did rebound. I'm not quite sure when he kind of collected himself and reopened again. But, you know, all during that period from 83, say, to 91, I believe, is when it burnt down. I mean, you look at the vast changing of the music industry in terms of what live music, especially. You've got the synthesizers, music changed the synthesizer. You have the drum machine now. You have all this, and which is a part of this visual and MTV thing. But the other part of that is that record company, there was independent record company distribution, which meant that these smaller bands, like we've mentioned before, Chapel Hill bands like the DBs or somebody like that, could have a record and then could get on MTV. And as a result, then that gave them some street cred. And next thing you know, they're playing at the Mad Monk. And so it was a great listening club. There was a mosh, if you will. It became a mosh pit. But, you know, people did dance. But mainly it was a kind of a listening club.
Yeah. Well, I definitely remember some mosh pits there in my day.
Yeah.
But, you know, and we should maybe make it clear to people that it wasn't necessarily wall-to-wall, like, nationally known headliners, right? I mean, it was mostly, I feel like, the kind of, the, you know, the bread and butter was these local regional bands that had to be, you know, two-thirds or three-fourths of who was really playing there. And then, you know, maybe once a week, once every other week, there was a pretty big name coming through.
But with the advent of these clubs, you know, the Mad Monk in Wilmington, the Attic in Greenville, you created the circuit, whatever it was in Chapel Hill, Cass Cradle, all those places. You created kind of a little mini circuit for bands to play and to get their music out and to make a little coinage and to pursue their dreams.
Yeah.
And so, that's where your Sidewinders come in.
Yeah.
That's where, you know, later you had a band called Storms that was from Wilmington that, you know, toured regionally. You know, Sponge Tones from Charlotte I saw there. And so you were able to, the ability to reach out as a local band, especially if you're even from Charlotte or Greenville or those kind of things, then you were able to have these clubs to be able to play your music.
Yeah, well, I mean, just in my recollection is that some of these local or regional bands would often draw better than, you know, because the national acts are ticket prices maybe a little more, you know, they'd get a good crowd, but it might not be a stone cold sellout where you get someone like, you know, After Forever and tickets are like $5 and there's 1,000 people in there.
I cannot tell you how excited it was as a local musician to play the Mad Monk. You've kind of arrived, you know, as a local band, that kind of thing. And so the other thing that we people don't really talk about, but as a musician at that time and being around a lot of folks similar in interest, it was something that inspired you to play. You have made it if, you know, you played the Mad Monk, you know, and so the word of mouth, all that. So, yeah, those crowds tended to be a lot larger.
Yeah. How often did you play there? I guess how many times?
I only played the Monk once with a band, and it was a part of a charity event in, I think, April 1986. It was part of the We Call This Place Home, which is Brad Thomas thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he had 7 or 8 bands play. It was for the burn unit of the hospital at the time, and it was just absolutely fabulous. And to be able to be a part of that and to reach out and be a part of the community of musicians, but also to play that stage, it just kind of legitimized you.
Yeah, and like I said, my memories of the old Monk, the original Monk, are hazy at best. I was underage for a good deal of it, and I do remember seeing the Sex Police there. My brother would go see all the heavy metal bands like Motorhead and Pantera, and they would get huge rowdy crowds. And I think that at some point they kind of had to. I know they used to be that they had put up no moshing signs because, you know, moshing was new. Moshing was scary.
Did you mosh, John?
I did not. You know what? I was kind of at the edge of it. I would kind of like, you know, push some guys by. But
I would like to see that, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't in there getting, you know, my head knocked off or anything like that. So
I think toward the end, especially in the 90s and then the second Mad Monk, as we're terming it, became more of a hair band, metal type of a club. And for whatever reasons, you know, certainly was a lot of folk were playing that and a lot of people were following it as well. So I wasn't really much of a patron to the older club as I was the newer club. I saw them back to the first Mad Monk, Leon Russell there. Jason and the Scorchers. These were just what off the top of my head. And Sponge Tones for the first time. Those kind of things.
Well, and then the people I've talked to, including Terry Kraft, who worked at the original, and then she kind of followed Charlie Maltzby over to the New Monk in 91 when they reopened there. She said that she would start taking him to, you know, conferences, South by Southwest. Right. He starts to meet all these booking agents and all these music industry people. And that's when they kind of became, in the early 90s, it seems like they kind of became more of a well-oiled machine, bringing all these acts in. I mean, for everyone, I mean, that's when you really got people like Marilyn Manson in there and like Diggable Planets from MTV and D-Light from MTV. Along with all these local bands.
Well, we haven't mentioned the Ramones, and I'm not sure. I'm not sure what version of the Ramones that was. People tell me I saw them, but I didn't.
Well, I heard there was a lot of going. I think you mentioned to me earlier. You know, a lot of people went to the Mad Monk. A lot of the memories maybe never got fully formed because of different things that were going on.
But you know, the charm of the place, I guess we can wax poetic and look back at it, you know, because, but, you know, physically, in terms of where that club was in Wilmington and or New Hanover County, it was really considered the outskirts of town.
Oh, for sure.
There was nothing there. You had the overpass, which was only two lanes at the time.
Oh my gosh.
You know, other than Hieronymus Restaurant, and
still there,
which
the
is still there, and these were old houses that had been converted. Glenn converted that to a restaurant. You know, there really was nothing there. It was literally the outskirts of town. So it kind of was like a roadhouse in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I know.
And it was kind of like tucked away, and you know, it was kind of like our little secret. There are all those kind of things, and as you think about it, you can kind of remember all these little nuances of it.
For sure. Well, and then, you know, which is very different. I think they kind of modeled the inside of the New Monk after the old one. It was different. It was basically in a strip mall, let's face it. The Marketplace Mall is basically a
Did it have the balcony on it?
They did have a balcony. We'll see. The old, I'm told the original was more of an L-shaped balcony.
Yeah.
At the second one, he kind of wrapped it all the way around,
like
built a big wooden balcony.
Yeah.
There was an actual pit built into the floor there.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of a little railing where you could kind of be back. It would get, I remember people telling me, you know, I think someone told me that used to work there, you know, they held about 1,000, you know, quote unquote, legally. Because,
wow.
You know, so sometimes, you know, it would get pretty crowded in there. And it was, Helmet played there. Helmet was a big, Paige Hamilton, great kind of jazz, hard rock player. They were very popular.
The other thing, too, and about both of them, in terms of competition locally, there really wasn't anything else like it. I mean, you know, with Liquor by the Drink starting in 79. I mean, it took the restaurant industry a few years and our bars really a few years to catch on to where they are, where they were going. And so it was still very young and in the process of all that. So there really wasn't any, excuse me, I'm trying to think of what would be considered competition in that time period. And locally, I don't really know where you could take a band and play loud music and bring in 400 or 500 people.
Yeah, that was like maybe Jacob's Run downtown to some extent. It was a little smaller. Oh, you know, not tiny.
That would have been later, I think, in the 80s, probably.
Yeah, but then there was, you know, and then there was always, you know, and they've...
Front Street News, downtown.
Yeah. People who've worked there have been very frank about, you know, Charlie Maltzy was very, you know what, if you want to play here, you need to only play here.
Right.
And, you know, that was kind of, you know, his way of kind of, you know, making sure that he could get a crowd for these local bands, which ironically, I don't know if ironically is the right word, but ironically, that exact same policy is the kind of thing that kind of began to spell the beginning of the end of the Mad Monk in the mid-90s when the House of Blues announced plans to open in North Myrtle Beach. And we all know about the famous, you know, blackout zone around the House of Blues.
It
where
truly
bands
was.
Weren't
yeah.
going to play.
Yeah, it was a kind of a limbo period in the late 90s for Wilmington in terms of those type of venues. And I think what you saw as a result, and maybe for your listeners, it basically meant that House of Blues artists, that if you played there, you signed a rider or a waiver saying that you would not play within a certain amount of time and a certain distance from that. And sometimes it'd be 6 or 8 months. Well, if you know anything about touring bands, you know, usually it's a one-shot deal. So we would, a lot of the opportunities that we found coming from the Mad Monk were dried up. And I think then you started to see the smaller venues like your Soapbox and Cowboys.
Oh, man. Cowboys was great in the 90s. That was really small.
Yeah. So you had the smaller venues. And as downtown started to develop its renaissance, as we say, you know, there were these little venues down there that were kind of doing it all, but could not handle the capacity or the charm to some degree of what the Mad Monk was doing.
Yeah, and then I think another factor, and you know, people I've talked to have said, you know, a lot of the bands that kind of, you know, came up in the Mad Monk, like Hootie and the Blowfish, Dave Matthews, you know, playing there famously for 100 people before anyone knew who they were, and then they would come back, and then the next crowd would be bigger the next time, and bigger the next time, and then the next time they came to town, they're playing outside. I think they kind of maybe lost... you know, they kind of graduated their class, right?
Yeah.
And then maybe the bands coming up behind them weren't drawing, you know, maybe like, you know, Hootie and the Blowfish were, for example.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Hootie and probably Dave Matthews, too, because, you know, from Columbia, South Carolina, however, they played a lot in the beach communities along the coast. And what was brilliant about that is that they'd play a lot of times in the summertime when there were a lot of tourists. And these tourists would bring these memories, or maybe they bought a record or a CD or whatever they were peddling, and went back to Ohio and went back to North New York and went back to where they were from in terms of visiting here in Wilmington. And as a result, Hootie especially developed a pretty good strategy and a marketing plan by developing these crowds and fan base in other parts of the country, even though they were not getting airplay and even though they were not playing in those places.
Yeah.
And so it kind of set the stage for them. And I think a little bit of Dave Matthews happened that way, but certainly with Hootie, that's the case.
Yeah, and then interestingly, you know, we were talking about MTV earlier. You know, by the mid-90s, they're not playing as many music videos.
Right.
They're doing like The Real World and all these reality shows, and they're still playing some music videos and all that. But maybe, you know, the charm has kind of, the bloom was off the rose to some extent. There's still plenty of touring bands, don't get me wrong. There's plenty of bands playing at the Monk right up to the very end in 96. But I think the House of Blues had announced plans to open, I want to say 97, late 90s. I feel like Charlie Maltzy kind of saw the writing on the wall, things were maybe starting to get a little rough already. He's heard about this kind of clause to where, you know, bands who play the House of Blues, the nice, newer, bigger, better paying House of Blues, yep. you know, maybe they're not going to come to the Monk anymore. So I think that's when Charlie's decided to kind of pull the plug. He already had another business, his bar Red Dogs out at Riceville Beach, so he had something to fall back on. And
cannot underestimate his influence and his ability to maintain this. Not only to say that it was getting tougher and tougher to operate a bar, not only because of responsibility of serving liquor, but also the DUI laws and things like that. It just became more and more complicated. And if you are an entity and a yeah. private citizen like Charlie was, then it certainly compounded your decision-making process of whether or not to continue or not.
Well, sure. And then I would be remiss not to mention, because at one point the Monk almost had its kind of its own publicity organ and Juice magazine.
Right.
I remember Terry Kraft telling me, going to the Star News at the time, trying to get write-up of some band or another that had a kind of an edgy name. They're like, well, we're not going to write about that band. And then Charlie was like, well, why don't you write your own, do your own magazine?
Yeah.
And then Juice magazine became, actually Juice magazine still exists. It's based out of California now. But so they had their own kind of little, magazine for a while that was basically, you know, publicity for the Monk. So, you know, as we wrap this up, what do you think the legacy of the Monk is? I mean, for one thing, I can say they were, reggae is still very popular in Wilmington, and it started with Charlie Maltby bringing reggae bands into the Monk.
It did. I think it's the longest, as we were discussing earlier before we went on air, it's the longest term music hall that we've had in contemporary time, and so you're almost talking about 13 years, which is a generation of folks, and I think that's probably its main legacy, and the do-it-yourself mentality of Charlie and being able to innovate and the process of being able to adapt to all these things that we were saying, more people being able to adapt to the movie industry and catering that, and being able to adapt to more of the local bands and becoming more prominent for regional things. It's not a static business, and he was somebody that actually had a great vision. So I think that's it. And I think there is a want or a need for that to come back. I'm not sure that that's the case. I think that was a very special time.
Yeah.
And, I guess as you get older, everybody says that was a special time. But truly, we looked at some of these cultural things and population and MTV and the movie studio and those kind of things. You can kind of put it all together.
Yeah, well, and then, the clubs that came after, you mentioned the Soapbox, Bougie Nights, which is still there. We're going to see what things happen after the pandemic shakes out.
Right.
But it was, we were both there. It was a special time. It was a special place. So, Jeff, I really appreciate you coming to talk
about
this,
John, thank you, man.
All right.
It's great, man.
All right, well, maybe,
And you sound great with your mask on, by the way.
That's right. I'm going to keep it on. And that's it for this episode of Cape Fear Unearthed and our look back at the Mad Monk. We'll be back soon with another chapter of Wilmington history. Till then, make sure you're a member of our Facebook group where listeners can ask questions about our episodes and share their own memories of the region's history. In that group, I post extra content from each episode and links to all my coverage of local history for the Star News. You can find that group by searching Cape Fear Unearthed on Facebook. And don't forget to sign up for the Cape Fear Unearthed newsletter that goes out every Thursday. Sign up for the newsletter at starnewsonline.com/newsletters. Cape Fear Unearthed was written, edited, and hosted by me, John Staten. You can find more of my work at starnewsonline.com. Additional editing was done by Adam Fish. This podcast was made possible by listeners and readers like you. Support local journalism and Cape Fear Unearthed by subscribing to the Star News today at starnewsonline.com/subscribe. And you know what? While you're subscribing to things, be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you stream this show so you never miss an episode. While you're there, leave us a review, which will help more people find Cape Fear Unearthed. Till then, get out and explore the Cape Fear region on your own. You never know what you might unearth.